Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, why infrastructure designers are flying blind as they try to plan for the future. We'll spend this hour with science reporter Shayla Love, talking about how engineers use historic conditions to predict future needs and why climate change has rendered such data nearly useless in a lot of places, as multiple 100-year floods happen within a decade and wild weather events destroy asphalt years sooner than expected. We'll talk about how engineers are coping with this new set of limitations and about the built environment and how it might change in response. Our conversation starts after a short break. Designing a dam or a bridge or a freeway overpass, you want it to be able to stand up to the elements as they occur in the place the project is built, and you want it to last for a long time. But as the planet warms, weather events grow more severe, which means not just worse drought, flood, heat, and cold, but more frequent oscillations between extremes. So how are engineers supposed to plan for a future they can't even predict? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Shayla Love is a senior staff writer at Vice who covers science, medicine, health, drugs, and climate. Recently, she's been reporting on a concept called stationarity, the idea that we can use past environmental data to predict future conditions. Engineers are realizing that climate change renders a lot of that historical information useless, so they are trying to figure out how to design stuff without knowing what might happen to it in the years to come. Love's recent article is called "Our Infrastructure is Being Built for a Climate That's Already Gone." Shayla, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
You open the piece with the discussion of a reservoir in the Oklahoma Panhandle called Optimal Lake, which was planned to hold enough water to be a draw for like 600,000 people a year to fish and boat and go swimming and camp nearby. You know, we're in North Texas. I was surprised I hadn't heard of it until I read that it never actually filled up with water.
Yeah, in 1979, the Army Corps of Engineer predicted that in 2014, this lake, which is in the panhandle of Oklahoma, would have 600,000 visitors per year and be this wonderful place for recreation and water sports. And instead, the lake has pretty much sat completely empty. It's just a dry expanse of land. You can Google a picture of it, and it doesn't look like a lake at all. It just looks like big empty nothingness. And so today it's still abandoned. It's never reached more than 5% of its capacity.
And it cost $45 million to build.
Exactly. And so it was originally, this lake and dam was originally built to control flooding from the nearby Beaver Creek and the North Canadian River. And so that was the purpose of building it. And they spent a lot of money on it. But one of the things that went wrong is that the planners had used historical flooding data to pick the spot where the dam would be. And by the time that it was done being built, that data was wrong and the water no longer flowed there.
So that's a waste of money. Meanwhile, there are places in the world dealing with more water than they'd anticipated. What's the situation in the Netherlands?
Yeah, exactly. So we can see this problem in the exact reverse happen. In the 1990s, a flooding barrier was put up in the Netherlands to protect Rotterdam. And that barrier will likely be insufficient 25 years earlier than they predicted because it was built in the 1990s. And the flooding that happened back then was much less severe than it is now. So replacing this barrier is probably going to cost around €1 billion, 10 million of which is just the cost of taking it down before they can build a new one. So we can already see in these examples how this is already happening. Using past climate data to build current infrastructure is already not working in many places.
So this brings us right to the concept that you introduce in the article, stationarity. What does the term mean to engineers, and how long has stationarity been used?
Yeah, so I first heard of stationarity when I heard some climate scientists talking about it, and they referred to it as a word that everybody knew, and I had never heard of it before. And so I asked, what is that? What does that mean? And I think it's funny that just people living in a society, most of us don't know this word, but it drives the way all the infrastructure around us has been built for a long time. So basically, stationarity is the idea that statistically, the past can help you predict and plan for the future. So all of the climate variations and water flow and rain, flood, temperature, storms, all of that stuff that happened in the past will remain stationary or constant. And so you can plan infrastructure for the future based on the past.
Did it used to work?
It definitely did. And stationarity has been one of the core concepts in engineering, especially in water engineering, up until about 20 years ago. So experts that I spoke to said that 20 years ago, there was almost no talk of non-stationarity, which is the opposite of stationarity, that the past no longer informs the future. So it's really only been in the last couple decades that engineers started to notice, you know, the way that we're coming up with our plans isn't working anymore. Or you have these cases of like, you know, we built this thing, it was supposed to last 50 years, it's failing us already. So this is a pretty recent development, and there's not really yet a good solution to it.
So maybe it's just a problem with the data. Where do engineers get the data they use in these calculations that no longer work very well to predict what's coming?
Yeah, so engineers make a lot of choices when they design infrastructure, and it completely changes depending on what part of the country you're in. So let's say you're designing a road that has a stormwater system, which is just a pipe underneath the road that moves water away from it. The size of that pipe would be completely different if you lived in San Diego or Minneapolis or New York City. And so engineers don't just pick something that they think sounds good. This process is really systematized. And at the national level, there are often engineering societies that make recommendations that make their way into city codes. So engineers get this data from weather stations, which have collected information on what's happened in the past. And those records go back about 40 to 60 years. So when they're making these decisions, they go to the National Weather Service or the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They put in what location they're in, and then they see what the past has been like. And so then they use that to design the infrastructure that they're building.
So, what conditions besides stormwater need to be factored into how infrastructure projects are built?
Yeah, this is another thing that I learned because, you know, when we think about infrastructure and climate change, the first thing we think about is water. But there's actually so much other infrastructure choices that the climate influences that you know don't come to mind right away. One thing is power lines. So if power lines get too hot, they can sag or short circuit and cause power outages. Another thing is our roads. So asphalt can crack at high temperatures, but you can design asphalt mixtures to withstand certain heats. And so what those mixture decisions are made using that same data. They look back and see how hot it got and what the probability of it getting really hot is, and then they make decisions even just about the roads. Things like the height of street curbs could also be influenced by stationarity data. And so, you know, we don't really think about that very often, our street curbs and how tall they are. But I heard one water expert say, you know, it could be in a very near future that all of our curbs are the wrong size. And it, you know, all of this applies to train tracks, airport runways, sewage systems. All of these things are designed using past climate data.
It's so interesting because I think for a lot of people who are not engineers, you know, we think asphalt is asphalt. Why not just use the highest grade asphalt in every possible project so that you're sure that you can withstand the kind of heat that might happen?
Right. I mean, this was as a, also a non-engineer, this is what I said. Why can't we just make everything really big and make everything with be able to withstand everything? But the main answer is cost, right? So things get really expensive, and it also is more complicated than everything getting hotter and wetter. In some places, they might actually end up drier. In some places, you know, the weather is going to change in unpredictable ways. It's not just that everything is moving in one direction. So climate modeling is imperfect. But let's say that, you know, one forecast estimates that flooding is going to get 12% worse in an area, or it's going to get 12% hotter. Does that mean that we should make the storm pipes 12% bigger or the asphalt 12% stronger? Like it's not really a one-to-one correlation. And so you don't want to blow the whole city's budget on creating impenetrable asphalt if you don't need to make it that strong. And I think so at the moment we're just dealing with cost limitations and how much we really have to spend on revitalizing all the infrastructure that's out there. It's very expensive.
Is there any way to revive stationarity by plugging in different kinds of historical data, maybe from the most extreme years on record, to do a better job of imagining future needs?
It, again, I don't believe that it's that simple, because while we shouldn't ignore the past, what we need to do is somehow combine what happened in the past with an uncertain future. And so statistically, this is just a really challenging task. And I think that, engineers and statisticians are still figuring out exactly how to make that work, because what's really at the core of all of this is uncertainty. So if you're dealing with probability and talking about a 1 in 100 year flood, those statistics just don't really work for us anymore. And so it's really about grappling, how can we make plans in the face of uncertainty rather than how can we predict what's going to happen? Because I think this just comes with the acceptance that we don't know what's going to happen.
All right, let's talk about those 100-year floods or even 500-year floods. Theoretically, the term means that an extreme event has like a 1 in 100 or 500 chance of happening in any given year. You have a city, though, like Houston that has seen multiple such flood events within a single decade.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Houston, all over the country, actually, there are more of these big weather events. I think from 2015 to 2016, there were 8 500-year floods recorded by the National Weather Service, and there were 6 1,000-year floods in the U.S. between 2010 and 2016, something like that. And so, I think, again, as a layperson who is not an engineer, I would think that a 100-year event means it's going to happen 1 in 100 years. But that's not right. What it means is that there's a 1 in 100 chance of it happening. A 10-year event similarly is, a 10% chance of occurring each year. But again, that's determined based on past data. That's why we're seeing more of these events. So if something had a 1 in 100 chance of happening, but the data that you're using to calculate that is from 1940 to 1970, that's why it doesn't apply anymore. If we were to, in 50 years, look back and recalculate it now, we would see that it would happen more frequently. So I think all of this is just a reckoning of how we even come up with these numbers. And it matters because we use all these numbers to make really concrete decisions about our infrastructure, and that affects the lives of literally everybody. So, it's all about grappling. How can we make decisions when these numbers that we've relied on for so long don't seem to work anymore?
Is there a push to change the terms we use for things? I mean, you can't call it a 1 in 1,000 year flood anymore if you're having a handful of them in just a couple of years. I don't know if that's confusing to sort of have everybody understand that a 1 in 500 year flood might happen twice in a decade.
I know. I think it is confusing. And I think, again, all this is really recent, and I think we're going to have to come up with new words for things, and embrace kind of the uncertainty that we're walking into. In 2008, there was a paper that came out in Science, which is a very prestigious journal, and the headline of it was that stationarity is dead. And it was this very influential group of scientists, a lot of them from the United States Geological Services, and that was kind of their call to this recognition that these words that we're using don't work anymore. Stationarity, this concept that we have been relying on and planning all of our infrastructure with, it's not just that, it sometimes work or sometimes doesn't, like it's dead. That was their proclamation. And so we need new words and new ways to think about things, now that we know that we're living in a non-stationary world.
And it's not as if everyone has agreed on what should come next, how we should handle the death of stationarity.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's still very much an open question. And I spoke to engineers who, it's not like any changes have really started to happen. I think in general, we're still planning things the way that we were. One of the engineers that I spoke to said that, one of his colleagues is a pavement engineer. And just like I said before, he's still using a temperature profile from 1970 to 1990 to plan pavement in 2020. But that's just the way things sort of function still, and that's the data that he's supposed to use in order to plan that. But even as an engineer actively working, he sort of knows that that's wrong. Like, how can I be using data that's so old when I know And it can experience that the weather is so different now, that the climate is so different now. And not only is it different in the present, but we can anticipate it's going to be much different in the future too.
My guest is Shayla Love, a senior staff writer at Vice who covers science, medicine, health, drugs, and climate. We're talking about her recent article, Our Infrastructure is Being Built for a Climate That's Already Gone. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Shayla Love. She's senior staff writer at Vice. She covers science, medicine, health, drugs, and climate. We're talking today about a recent article she wrote called Our Infrastructure is Being Built for a Climate That's Already Gone. It's about the death, as it were, of a concept called stationarity, used in engineering to predict the future based on past data. You mentioned before the break, Shayla, that some engineers are, you know, sort of doing what they've been told to do and relying on data from between 1970 and 1990. We do have 30 years of data since 1990. Is it more helpful to use more recent information from the time after the climate began changing?
I think the most recent data that we can use is definitely helpful, but I think kind of the underlying message of stationarity being dead is that even what's happening at the present will not perfectly predict what's going to happen in the future. We've changed the climate too much to rely on anything that's happening now or 2 years ago or 3 years ago to be able to perfectly understand what's going to happen. So the reason for that is that when temperatures rise, there's more evaporation, which leads to more droughts in some areas, but also a lot more moisture in the atmosphere, so more rainfall and floods in other areas. So sea levels have risen, summers are getting hotter, Hurricane Harvey was 15% more intense because of climate change. And so we're seeing things change so rapidly, even within such a short period of time. Every year, the average temperature keeps raising, and we can assume that that's probably going to keep happening unless radical changes happen, which we're not really seeing. So I think this is less about asking what data in the present can help us predict the future and sort of throwing the whole idea away that anything that is happening now is going to be completely, predictive of what's going to happen.
Because even perfect data from the last 20 or 30 years doesn't reflect the fact that the climate is still changing.
Exactly. And that's the part where this uncertainty comes into it. So even if we could take, let's say we're going to throw away all the data from 1970 to 1990 and only use things from 2010 to 2020, it still doesn't, maybe that would give us something that's good for now, but it still doesn't anticipate what the future holds. And so, I think that's where this is sort of psychologically uncomfortable, because it forces us to realize how much our behaviors have really changed the world that we live in the sense that we don't know what's going to happen. And it will change so much depending on what our future actions are, both politically and personally, and whether or not, the world decides to take climate change really seriously.
And clearly, we don't have unlimited time to adjust to all this. In many parts of the country, these climate-related emergencies are happening in real time. You remind us here that, they can take out multiple kinds of infrastructure at once: roads and bridges and power lines and water and sewer systems.
Yeah, so these are called cascading events, and it reveals how interconnected our infrastructure systems are. So in 2011, there was a heat wave that led to 20 different infrastructure failures in only 11 minutes. And that affected millions of people in Arizona, California, and Mexico. And that's things like, the power goes out, then the sewage system stopped functioning, then drinking water is affected, maybe the power lines fell and damaged the road. And so all of these things are just the basics that we don't really think about when we go through our everyday life, turning the tap water on in our kitchen or flushing the toilet or walking outside, onto a road that's not cracked and messed up, turning the lights on. All of these things can be, just gone in a second. And I think we're going to start seeing that more and more, not to mention with flooding, right? Then that's a whole other issue.
So is an engineer who's in charge of a municipality's, say, water and sewer systems, is she likely to be in contact with her counterpart who is working on something like power lines?
I think it depends. I think that there's a real push for more interdisciplinary city planning, especially when it comes to sort of like on the city level. But I think one big issue here is that, like we've talked about before, this notion that we live in a non-stationary world is very new. So we need to completely revitalize the way we think about city planning, and that involves, more funding and more communication between different departments. But the Trump administration released an infrastructure revitalization plan in the first years of his administration, and it didn't mention climate change at all, nor did it discuss the necessity of anticipating this uncertainty that's going to come with designing infrastructure now and in the future. And so I think we're really talking about policy and about funding that allows these experts and engineers to do what they need to do. I think they all recognize that this is an issue. It's just about empowering them to talk to each other and think about the uncertainty that's to come.
So let's say that we recognize there is a new normal in terms of extreme swings in climate conditions. Will it be possible to even know what is normal anymore, even in any given, say, 5 or 10 year period?
Yeah, I'm not sure if we can. I mean, I think again that to me the concept of non-stationarity is a really apt metaphor for climate change. We can no longer operate in the past. We can't operate in the present like we have in the past, and we've changed things so much that we don't know what our future is going to be like anymore. And so, this is the new normal. The normal is that there is no normal. Nothing is certain, everything is unpredictable, and so we need to accept that and plan for infrastructure that can accommodate uncertainty, which sounds really hard, but there are ways that people are going about trying to do that.
So let's talk about that. You said earlier that one idea as a solution is to just overbuild everything using the strongest possible materials, but that might make the costs prohibitive and it might not work the way we want it to. Another idea might be to build less robust projects with an eye toward replacing them more often. What are the pros and cons of something like that?
Yeah, I mean one big issue is if you decide you're just going to build the strongest thing possible, is you could still be wrong, right? Like let's say that we want to build a dam, and we think that we're building something that's so big it can never fail. We could still be wrong about that, and then you've spent tons of money on something that's really hard to adjust after the fact. So I think the idea now is to try to develop infrastructure that's somehow flexible and adaptable, rather than being really sturdy or unchanging and permanent. And so this doesn't mean to build weak things. No one wants to drive over a bridge that's, kind of rickety and meant to be replaced in a year or two. But thinking about, things that are modular or inherently adaptable, having compatibility of hardware. Your iPhone charger is not super adaptable, but a USB cord is, right? That can fit into multiple different devices. So thinking about how infrastructure can grow or shrink on its own and have that built into its design. This is a very different than the way we think about infrastructure now. I mean, I know, again, thinking about roads or bridges, I want them to be really strong and sort of permanent. But this calls for us to kind of think differently about how we design and build things, and how they might be used for other purposes. A really good example of this is that in Kuala Lumpur, they have tunnels for traffic that can double as storm drainages. So if there's ever one of these big flooding events, they have this built-in infrastructure that's used for something else, but in the case of an extreme event, it can drain water out. So that's a really great example of adaptability and flexibility that's built into the design.
It's interesting because I can see how the idea of that would be terrifying to people. That, when a flood is coming, you block off the traffic, I guess, to allow for water to flow through there. I mean, psychologically, it had to be a lot to get people's minds around that.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think we all want our infrastructure to feel really safe. But again, I think part of accepting that we live in a really uncertain time is reframing what our idea of safe is. I think another really good example of this is that we need to build infrastructure that is safe to fail. So traditionally, we have our infrastructure designed to be fail-safe up to a certain point. And so that certain point might be a 1 in 5,000 year event. But then once it fails, we don't really think about what happens when it fails. So safe to fail is kind of the opposite of that. You know, you design infrastructure, but then you think seriously, okay, what's going to happen when this breaks? And you make sure that you design from the outset what will happen if and when it fails you, and make sure that what happens isn't that bad, or that you have a backup system. You know, I think those traffic tunnels are a good example of that. What happens in an extreme weather event if whatever we have that's blocking the water fails us, and here's the backup, and it's an adaptable, you know, reusing of something that we already have. So it feels counterintuitive to plan already that our infrastructure is failing, but the fact is that it probably will fail. And so we need to think about the ways that it'll fail and build things that are safe to fail.
It makes me think about, a lot of office buildings have these carpet tiles now rather than laying down sheets of carpet, because inevitably something gets spilled and something has to be replaced, and it's cheaper and easier to take up one tile and replace it than to do the whole place.
Absolutely. And, you know, another phrase that an engineer told me that I really liked is called minimizing future regret. And that's, again, just thinking from the very beginning when you're planning something. If I'm wrong, if I planned this using, you know, whatever data or some modeling, you know, some projection of what the climate's going to be like, and I'm wrong, how much am I going to regret my mistake? And again, this is just a completely different way of thinking about it, but we have to, because everything is so uncertain. And so I think just having these conversations right at the outset, there's a field of decision science that's emerging now called decision making under deep uncertainty. And this is also similar to this. It's, you know, you plan out a bridge or a dam or whatever, but then you try to predict a whole bunch of different future conditions that might occur, and you walk through each one of those outcomes. And so instead of planning a project and not really thinking about that, you would say, okay, let's see what would happen to this dam that we built if the climate warms by 2 more degrees in the next 50 years, or 5 more degrees in the next 50 years, or 0.5 degrees in the next 50 years. So not everybody does that right now, and I think it's just something that we're going to have to acclimate to and accept.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What is involved, Shayla, in gaming out all the possible things that could go wrong with an infrastructure project?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one good example of this is in the UK, the Thames Estuary 2100 project. So they were one of the first to really do this deep uncertainty decision-making model. So right at the beginning, so this was a large plan to upgrade or replace this barrier that protects London from flooding. So instead of just looking into the past and saying, you know, what were all the times that this river flooded from 1950 up to 2015 or something? They planned out all of these multiple options for the future, and they created this adaptation map, which had different choices arising depending on what was going on with the climate. So I described it kind of like a choose your own adventure book. So before the future even happens, they have this outline of, you know, let's say in 10 years, the river is flooding way more than it usually does. They can go to this book that they already planned everything out in advance, and go to the scenario in which the river is flooding too much, and have, you know, steps of what they're going to do to mitigate that damage. So it's just about, it takes a lot more work, obviously, to try to plan for all these future scenarios that we don't know yet. But I think it's the only way to sort of cost effectively deal with all of the uncertainty that's going on. Another big thing, speaking about cost, is, you know, the way that we budget for things now is, you know, you have a budget, let's say it's $50 million for a project, and then you spend the money when the project is completed, then you're done. This also accounts for, you know, maybe there's $35 million to build the thing itself, but you're planning on it not being done from the outset. You're planning on having to adapt it in the future. And so the budget costs go beyond just the completion, but they account for, you know, maybe we're going to have to make this thing taller in the future, or maybe it's not going to be as strong you know, as we need it to be. And so then we can use that money for something else. Maybe it needs to be extended longer. And so you save some money for the end, so you're not scrambling, and also not wasting money.
It seems like that sort of thing is going to require a re-education of lawmakers and the people who are allocating these budgets. How is that going?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, right? Climate change has become a political issue. And when I speak to engineers, they just emphasize so much how apolitical this is. I mean, infrastructure is something that people think is quite boring and they don't want to think about it until it breaks. And then suddenly it affects your quality of life so much. I mean, it's worth mentioning too that, of course, infrastructure failures often affect communities of people of color and of low socioeconomic class first. And so, these are disproportionately affecting certain groups of people, and that's just not fair. So, one engineer said to me, like, this is just completely apolitical. What we're doing isn't working. And so I think there just needs to be this, rather than getting stuck in the politics of it all, just talking about what things are breaking, right? I think, like engineers should present examples of why things are breaking, why they're not holding up the way they're supposed to, and then just talk about how much money we're really wasting by doing it this old way. Because even though these projects sound expensive, think about, again, that dam and lake in Oklahoma. That was just money thrown away, basically. Now it's just an empty expanse of land that isn't doing any good to anybody, and they spent so much money building that. If we use our money smartly, we can both preserve quality of life through basic infrastructure design, and also maybe save money in the end.
Do engineers feel like they have to serve political aims in a way that they're not comfortable with simply to get done what they think needs to get done?
I don't think that's true. I think that there's just a general frustration around people who are dealing with the realities of climate change and sort of seeing in the news this still like discussion about whether or not this is happening, whether or not this is caused by man-made changes or just natural fluctuation in the planet's climate. I think we know extremely clearly based on past modeling that what we're experiencing now is unprecedented, and yet Trump removed us from the Paris Agreement. There's just I think there's just general frustration that it seems like we're not doing enough fast enough, and that also makes the future even more uncertain and the past data even less reliable when we don't see vast political action to counter climate change.
Shayla Love is a senior staff writer at Vice. Her recent article is called "Our Infrastructure is Being Built for a Climate That's Already Gone." I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Shayla Love. She's a senior staff writer at Vice. She covers medicine, health, drugs, science, and climate. The article we're talking about today is one called "Our Infrastructure is Being Built for a Climate That's Already Gone." It's about the fact that engineers are having to cope with the fact that stationarity, a concept that used past historical data to predict what infrastructure needs might be in the future, is no longer working. So just to go back for a minute, Shayla, to this idea of designing to minimize future regret, that speaks to a values question, doesn't it? Because which will you regret the most? Will you regret that there has been damage to property? Will you regret that certain communities have been more affected than others? Will you regret, human injuries and deaths? Does everyone agree on what future regrets we should try hardest to prevent?
No, they don't. And that's such a good point that regret is a really subjective word. And I think, this aligns really well with the concept of climate justice, which is that within climate change, there's going to be a lot of changes to societies, both the physical infrastructure that make them up, where we live, what cities are protected. And we need to think about what's right when we make these choices. There's a concept called managed retreat, which is the idea that cities that are right on the coasts are not going to be inhabitable forever. And sea levels are rising, especially if we don't do anything. And so should we retreat from the coasts? How can we do that in an equitable way rather than just creating cities with huge walls around them that push water to other poor communities? And so I think, there is no talk about climate change without a talk about what's right and what people are going to benefit from certain decisions and what people aren't. And I think we're already seeing, so many examples of people who have lived in communities that are just sort of forgotten or not helped. And then when there are these big extreme weather events, they're just sort of left on their own. So I think that's a really crucial part of this conversation, and I think it needs to be ongoing, and we don't really have a good answer to it yet. I would just suggest that everybody has the basic right to clean water and electricity, and basic infrastructure around them. I think if we use that as a starting point, everything that happens from there will just be an ongoing conversation.
Can infrastructure be used to either reinforce or eliminate divisions between neighborhoods? I'm thinking about something like the Flint water crisis. I mean, it was much worse. The contamination was much worse in certain areas of Flint that were largely home to people of color.
Again, managed retreat is a really fascinating area to look at this. Some people who study managed retreat envision it as a way to deal with social and racial inequities. So, a way to provide housing, safe housing, and infrastructure, water, electricity to people who didn't have it before. If you think about the coast and all of the rich cities on the Northeast, for example, that exist on the coast, one option of the future in climate change would be that we erect these huge just walls around the city, but then think about who gets to live there. Just rich people will live behind the wall, and then poor people will be scattered on the outer edges of the wall, where the water will be pushed, and you'll be creating this really inequitable situation. But another version of managed retreat takes those social inequities into account, and it proactively tries to address them. I spoke to one person who talked about how, there could be a future in which the US shores are reclaimed as public land. And so it would be a national shoreline that serves as this buffer to the ocean. And if it was paired with affordable housing, community investment, and employment, moving away from the coasts, in 50, 100, 150 years would not only help us survive, but provide a better quality of life to everybody. So I think climate justice is just crucial when we talk about any of these issues about infrastructure or thinking about how our cities are going to be planned in the future and who's going to live where, and who's going to really bear the brunt of having to deal with worse living conditions because of climate change.
We have an email here from John who writes, Houston appointed a hurricane czar. I understand some cities are considering heat czars to deal with problems associated with soaring temperatures. Is there any consensus on how much these types of positions will change the responses to crises or advocate for more funds into emergency response systems?
I think it's a great idea to appoint somebody whose job is to advocate for considering how the climate is changing. I don't know that much about the Houston hurricane czar, but I will say that, this is not something probably that one single person is going to be able to fix. I know this is a, this is an issue that a lot of individuals that I speak to have too, where people are really trying to do their best to recycle and, take public transit instead of driving anywhere and do these individual actions. But the reality is that it's, a small handful of large companies that produce the most carbon emissions. It's governments as a whole that choose to participate or not participate in trying to reduce carbon emissions. Just like it's part of a larger city infrastructure that makes decisions about how much money to spend, who to hire, and how to plan for a city's infrastructure. And so I think that, a hurricane czar or a heat person sounds wonderful, and it means that there's attention being paid to it. But I think that everybody should try to adopt the mentality, especially if you're working in city government or making policies, that everybody is sort of a hurricane czar, especially if you live in an area where that's affecting your people, because all these other issues that we think about on a day-to-day basis, they're all affected by climate. Climate is this sort of issue that sits on top of everything else that we're worrying about, with the, on the level of the COVID-19 crisis. I mean, these are equally overpowering forces that we have to face. It's just that climate change is still around the bend while we're still in the midst of COVID.
Well, I'm glad you brought up COVID because it's a really interesting dimension to all this. Now we have both public facilities, but also a lot of private businesses and entities suddenly having to retrofit for something we didn't really imagine would affect everyone. Individual cities or states or even countries might have imagined they'd be affected, but we didn't necessarily think the whole world would have to do social distancing for a year or more.
Yeah, and I had actually started writing this article before COVID got really bad in the US, and I put it on pause, and then when I finished it, it was, I live in New York City and we had been hit really, really hard. And so one thing I was speaking with these engineers about is that this idea of designing adaptable and flexible infrastructure is applicable in way more than just roads and bridges and power lines. We should be thinking about this everywhere. I mean, we're living in a modern world, the likes of which has never really been seen before on our planet. And that includes medical infrastructure. So, our medical infrastructure was only able to handle extremes it had dealt with in the past. It's the same concept as infrastructure and climate data. It wasn't able to adapt to this new unprecedented extreme event. And that doesn't mean that we need to, I mean, that we need to build bigger hospitals as big and as huge as possible to anticipate something, but we needed to be adaptable. We were not able to easily scale up testing, contact tracing, or any policies that could help people as the country shut down. We ran out of ventilators. We didn't have enough PPE. All of these things reveal how sort of static our infrastructure is and how we're really only prepared for what we've dealt with now or in the past. And so when we think about a future in which, population growth, resource demands, climate change, pandemics, there are all of these uncertainties in the future. How can we just accept this non-stationarity in almost every realm that we exist in and try to be adaptable in the face of that?
So interesting because I think you have a human nature problem here. Because I think now we can understand that we should have planned better, we should have had more stockpiles of PPE and ventilators and whatever, but it could have been a different kind of emergency. And I think if 3 years or 10 years ago someone had said, you can save a lot, later on in 2020 by putting aside resources to do this, it would have seemed so remote that it would have been hard to get people's heads around it and get support for it.
I know. I mean, I think you're right. This is a human nature problem. It's really hard for us to care about things until they're happening right now, and even more so care about things until they're happening to somebody you know, right? I mean, we even have a problem in this country of getting people to wear masks, which is not a very difficult or costly thing, but it would be a great public health initiative. And it's, I think it we're just going to have to change the way that we think and try to be ready for unpredictable things. Again, I think the goal is not to assume that you can figure out how to predict what's going to happen. It's about accepting that, things might get worse in various areas. There might be another pandemic, some virus that we don't yet know about. The climate may change in ways that are really bad. We can probably say it's going to get worse, but we don't know how much. How can we create flexible systems that can try to adapt to worsening conditions while accepting that we have no idea what those are going to be? And that's really uncomfortable because we all like to feel like we're in control and we know what's going to happen. But accepting that we don't know can actually help us in the long run because I think, you just don't want to be caught with your pants down like we were with COVID or like cities have been when they have huge flooding events and suddenly there's nothing you can do.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones now. We have James on the line in Slidell. Hi, James.
Yes, I was just listening to all the comments that your guest has made, and I just see it as a problem that needs to be solved, not a political issue. And things become such a political issue till you can't get the problem solved. That's my comment.
Thanks for calling. Do you want to respond to that, Shayla?
I completely 100% agree. And I think that anybody working in climate science or infrastructure design would also completely 100% agree.
You note, Shayla, we also need to think about our own, individual behavior and choices. We can't live the way we did in a pre-climate change world because our living choices have different consequences now.
Yeah, and I said before that stationarity and non-stationarity are these really apt metaphors to think about the climate crisis. And I said before that individual actions matter in the context of also larger policy decisions and regulation of these large companies that contribute a lot to carbon emissions. But even outside of that, it's helpful to just remind ourselves that the planet we're living on now is not the one that existed in the past. And if that really helps it, as our caller said, if that really helps it not be a political issue and just sort of a matter of fact, I think that's helpful. I really liked the name of that science paper, Stationarity is Dead, because to me it was sort of an homage to Nietzsche, who wrote that God is dead. And what he meant by that was that, during the Enlightenment, there was this progression of science and philosophy and society no longer needed to frame itself around the rules of religion and faith. And so now that stationarity is dead, there's another thing that we don't have faith in anymore, which is this constant, unchanging world and this promise that a future will be just like the past. And so, individually, I think that's quite profound, as well as on a systems level.
So everybody notices and everybody suffers when infrastructure fails. Why is this one of those subjects that you and I as journalists can sometimes struggle to get people to pay attention to? I mean, you do a lot more reporting on this. We just do the occasional show. But it's one of those things where I really feel like we have to sort of make the case to the audience, like, stick with us. This is important.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question to ask. And I admit that on the outset, the thought of digging into infrastructure research seemed really boring to me as well. But I think, I think it reveals how functional our infrastructure has been in many places up until now. You know, it reveals that when it works really well, it sort of fades into the background and becomes invisible. I don't think twice when I go to my kitchen and turn on the water in the morning. I don't think about that at all. I don't think twice about turning my lights on. But it also reflects the deep privilege that I come from. There are lots of people in the world who don't have access to water and lights or paved roads, who infrastructure matters a great deal to them. So I think, you know, one of the things with stationarity and non-stationarity is the goal is to keep infrastructure sort of something that's humming along in the background that we don't have to worry about too much, because that means that it's working. So I think that we need to get people to care. But, you know, it's something that I think the goal of it should be that we don't want to think about it too much as a person who's just living in society.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost a victim of its own success in terms of getting people to pay attention and to allocate appropriate resources to keeping it working.
Yeah, you'll always notice if your city is flooding, of course, but if nothing's wrong, you just go about your day and take it for granted. So, you know, I think that we should care a lot more about it and making it successfully a wallflower into the future.
Do politicians need to be more specific when they talk about fixing infrastructure? We say that a lot, but we don't often talk about exactly what that will mean.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely an issue. A lot of the time when people talk about fixing infrastructure, they talk about already failing infrastructure that just needs to be repaired. Mm-hmm. And that's a big difference than what we've been talking about this hour. We're talking about designing adaptable infrastructure for an uncertain future, not just fixing this bridge that seems to be falling apart. And this, again, goes back to sort of the waste of resources. Are you really going to spend a ton of money restoring a bridge, say, using past climate data, when that could really be a moment to think about the future?
Shayla Love is senior staff writer at Vice. She covers climate, among other scientific topics. Her recent article is "Our Infrastructure is Being Built for a Climate That's Already Gone." Shayla, thanks for making time for us again.
Thank you for having me.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. We hope that you'll subscribe to the Think podcast. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.